Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean air than there was the year before that. Every year there are fewer.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last in the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. So thanks to AfroZen for his music and his intro. As always, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This October 27th, 2015 edition, episode 61 of Nature Bats Last comes to you live from the Mud Hut. And somewhere in Arizona where Guy is trying to call in at the moment. Our thanks to, again, AfroZen for his contribution. Today's show we have a guest expert, primitive expert, John Feeney, and also a call-in show today, so we'll be taking your calls. Please dial us up toll-free at 1-888-874-4888. That's 1-888-874-4888. Guy, you there with us yet or not? Or am I on my own at the moment? Well, Guy, start us off. You have something to say.
Yes. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Are we on?
We are on.
Sorry about that. Oh, my. A little busy here. I'm driving on the interstate eating processed food, food in quotes, of course, from plastic containers. Ditto for the iced tea. Pulled off the road to do the show. I'm calling in by my cell phone, and I'm connecting with the other cell phone so we can do instant messages to keep up with each other on the show. And I'm telling you, if we had decent technology and a decent cellular signal, I wouldn't have to pull off the road at all. two anti-civ guys interviewing an anti-civ guy, and I'm completely awash in technology here.
Wouldn't have it any other way. Let's get to our guest. John Feeney, PhD, writes about fundamental drivers and historical underpinnings of the global ecological crisis. His work has appeared in the BBC's Green Room, The Guardian, The Canyon Country, Zephyr, The Oil Drum, and elsewhere. Working in part from a deep ecology perspective, John explores the root causes of humanity's destructive impact on the biosphere. Underreported in the media, the impacts of these issues are severe and pervasive. They raise questions going to the foundations of civilization. John received a 2009 Global Media Award from the Population Institute for his creation of the Global Population Speak Out, and a 2007 Eco Award from the Earth Community Organization for the essay Six Steps to, quote-unquote, Getting the Global Ecological Crisis. He began investigating conservation and environmental issues while fighting residential growth in a small town where he and his family lived for 2 years. His research pointed inevitably to the destructive role played by the growth imperative in modern society. Frustrated that few writers were willing to tackle the subject, he ventured to add his voice to the small ranks of those who do. Since then, his work has led him back 10,000 years and farther into the human past to investigate the origins of the global ecological crisis and to question the wisdom of civilization. He encourages wider recognition of the immediate return hunting and gathering societies demonstrate the most ecologically benign human life way with by far the longest track record of sustainability. John grew up in the Sonoran Desert of Arizona, graduated from the University of Colorado at Boulder, then obtained a PhD from California School of Professional Psychology at San Diego, where he trained in the scientist-practitioner model. He later spent some years as a professional poker player, writing a highly regarded book on the subject. Today, John lives with his family in the American Southwest, where he journeys into the deserts and the mountains whenever possible. Welcome to Nature Bats Labs and the Progressive Radio Network, John.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Good to be here.
Good to have you. You know, we talk a lot on this show about civilization and its origins, and inevitably, it for us and many people, it tends to lead to agriculture, but you have a slightly different take, and you talk about really immediate return and delayed return societies, and I was wondering if you could kind of explain the differences.
Right, right. Well, people who recognize the destructive nature of civilization tend to look back for, you know, where did this all begin? Where did we take that initial wrong turn? And as recently as a few years ago, I felt like most people do that it was probably with the advent of agriculture. But as I continued looking into this and reading up a little bit on the anthropology, I found that there was another turn taken or another shift not too long before the advent of agriculture, though we don't know exactly when, but in the upper Paleolithic, maybe 10 to 15,000 years ago, maybe a little farther back. And that was the shift from what James Woodburn termed immediate return hunting and gathering to delayed return hunting and gathering. And it's a very important distinction. Immediate return hunter-gatherers are, as far as we know, they are what our ancestors were for the great bulk of human history. All humans were immediate return hunter-gatherers. And there are still tragically few immediate return hunter-gatherer societies left in the world, such as the Hadza in Tanzania, the Batek in Malaysia, a handful of others. Basically, immediate return hunter-gatherers, look at the term itself, immediate return. It's talking about their subsistence method, and it's saying that their returns on labor are more or less immediate. So it's a relative thing, but it's the basic idea is, you know, you pick the berries, you eat some, you take the rest back to camp and eat them over a day or two. So close to immediate returns on labor. As well, they are oriented toward the present, tend toward little food storage, not zero food storage, but less than delayed return. Use simple, portable, easily replaceable tools and weapons. They live nomadically or semi-nomadically. And they live, this is one thing that's always a little pet peeve of mine, they live in bands and not tribes. We often hear about tribal societies and tribal living. Well, for most of human existence, we didn't live in tribes. We lived in bands, which are just basically smaller than tribes, maybe 25 to 50 people as opposed to, say, a few hundred. They also use very simple, portable, easily replaceable tools, and they're well known for being what they call fiercely egalitarian. This kind of living tends to support an egalitarian social structure. And they tend to maintain that strongly. They have mechanisms in place socially to maintain that egalitarianism. Now, delayed return hunter-gatherers first emerged somewhere around, like I said, maybe 10 to 15,000 years ago. And again, this is James Woodburn's term. He coined these terms in around the late 70s, early 80s. They invest in work over more time. So it brings returns on labor after longer time delays. They store more food, and that seems to be linked with a complexity that develops out of their society. They store larger quantities of food, and this seems to lead to someone needing to control the food, leads to stratification and hierarchy, a more complex society, sometimes all the way to including things like slavery. And their tools are more elaborate, there's more specialization, and so on. And so those are delayed return hunter-gatherers. A couple of overlapping terms, because I might use these interchangeably at times. Immediate return hunter-gatherers are also called simple hunter-gatherers. The terms are not exactly synonymous, but they overlap a lot. Delayed return, called complex hunter-gatherers. So they talk about the development of complexity and when complexity emerged in the archaeological record, for instance. And I have come to see this this shift from immediate to delayed return or simple to complex as possibly being as important or maybe in a foundational sense more important than in the advent of agriculture. It seems to be the thing that laid the foundation for agriculture and kind of made possible where we're at today, which, of course, is not too good, as you guys know. I'll run a quick quote by you just so that, you know, it's not just my own idea, but anthropologist Ernest Birch said, "In my judgment, the most definitive division of small-scale societies identified so far is not between foraging and agrarian, but between immediate return and delayed return societies, or non-storing and storing societies." As Testart put it, and this is continuing Birch's quote, "Agriculturalists and storing hunter-gatherers are neatly in opposition to non-storing hunter-gatherers. Immediate return societies are so unlike all others that, as Birdsell once noted, it's difficult even for anthropologists who have not personally experienced one to conceive how they can exist." So I think one quick way to simplify the whole thing is just to think of immediate return hunter-gatherers as hunter-gatherers who are doing only what's necessary to live reasonably comfortably. They don't go much beyond that. So that's pretty much the distinction. And it did seem to lay the groundwork for agriculture. Not everyone agrees with that, but some of the writers I'll be mentioning actually pretty much acknowledge that in their writing. So, yeah, that's that.
Guy, you there?
Can you hear me? Yeah, thanks for that. In any event, this is Guy. In any event, the big transition seems like it occurs within the last few thousand or several thousand years.
Yeah.
And can you tell us why that matters exactly when? And also,
hello?
Did we lose Guy?
Can you tell us the importance of the differentiation between bands and tribes?
Okay, well, you cut out on us for just a second there, Guy, I think. Can you repeat that?
Sorry about that. Can you tell us why it matters whether it was 10,000 or 15,000 years ago? And also why it matters the difference between bands and tribes. Because
bands and tribes, that's always a little pet peeve of mine, just because if you're talking about immediate return hunter-gatherers, which is what humans were for most of our existence, you're talking about bands, but constantly, like on the internet, you hear people talking about tribes and tribal, and so they're really, when they say that, they're really only referring back maybe as far as 10 or 12,000 years, and they're kind of ignoring the groups that people lived in for most of our existence. There are a lot of anthropological observations about bands that make them different from tribes. They tend to be, of course, they're nomadic, and there is much easier movement between bands. So if someone doesn't like the band they're in, they just move over to another band where they probably know half the people anyway. And that actually happens pretty often. It's been documented. So and these bands, because they are immediate return, they're egalitarian. It's bands and tribes is basically the distinction between immediate return and delayed return in many ways. Now, what I want to get into today and what makes a lot of this so important is that a few years ago I started thinking about this, and I was noticing that a lot of people under the general category, say, of primitivists, people from rewilders to anarcho-primitivists to more recently there's a group calling themselves wildists, all kind of in the general category of primitivists, so, though some might object to that, but best term I can come up with. A lot of them really embrace a way of subsistence known as indigenous land management, or sometimes called tending the wild, after the title of a book by M. Cat Anderson. And they look back to see where did we go wrong, what was sustainable, what was workable, and they go back before agriculture. They may look at horticultural societies, which appeared about the same time as agriculture, more like gardening. But in my view, they represented a rather sudden shift out of the ecological niche that humans had occupied before that, and so I think raise a red flag. But many go back to something even a little bit less transformative than horticulture or horticultural societies, and they look at indigenous land management. As I said, it's often called tending the wild in discussions online. But when you look at the literature, I think a more common term is indigenous land management. So I started wondering about this because I thought, geez, you know, the hunter-gatherers that I've read about, the Juwazi, also known as the San Bushmen in the Kalahari, the Hadza in Tanzania, the Mbuti, the Batek, they don't seem to do a lot of this land management. I wonder, do they necessarily do any of it? Is there something going on here that I don't quite get? Because I was hearing comments from people to the effect that that these land management approaches had been universal among hunter-gatherers going back to the earliest humans and always practiced extensively. And I thought, wait a minute, this just doesn't seem to square with the groups I've read about. So I started looking into it, and I concluded that indigenous land management really came into its own with delayed return societies. Now, it's a little more complex than that because you see little bits of indigenous land management in immediate return societies sometimes. But what was interesting to me was the first three immediate return societies I even looked into, I found that in two of them, well, I found that in one of them there was a little bit of this land management in the form of burning. In two of them, there was either none, or there was either very little or none at all. So that immediately kind of put to rest the idea that this was always practiced extensively by all hunter-gatherers. It simply wasn't. I mean, I got this both from poring over the literature on different societies as well as querying several anthropologists about it. So I kept looking at these assertions made about indigenous land management and wondering why people embraced this so enthusiastically. There were other assertions made not only that it was universal and extensively practiced, but that it went back, say, some would say to the earliest humans. M. Cat Anderson, in her book Tending the Wild, makes a reference to it going back possibly 30 to 50,000 years. But she provides no citation, so you can't really check to see where she's getting that. It turns out that with the exception of burning, there's really no archaeological evidence of this stuff going back anything like 30 to 50,000 years. And the evidence for burning is very debatable as well, and we can get into that. But burning in Australia may go back 40, 50,000 years. We're not absolutely sure. We do know, or we don't know, but there's heavy debate about whether this burning was really as extensive as a lot of people would have us believe. There have been hypotheses that the entire fire regimes in Australia increased in ways that indicated the human thumbprint of fire, if you will, on human arrival. But there have been some major studies done that have looked at that very carefully and found the evidence lacking. So that's kind of what I'm getting at today, is that this indigenous land management, as nice as it sounds, I think it really was a product primarily of delayed return societies, and it seemed to give people a way of dealing with a changed worldview. There's an author named Morris Berman who wrote a book called Wandering God, and in that he talks about the immediate return, the immediate return hunter-gatherer consciousness versus a change when delayed return hunter-gatherers came along, a change in their perception of the world. And immediate return hunter-gatherer consciousness was one of like vivid immediacy. Nature was trusted to provide as needed. As one author put it, they lived off of flow rather than stores. With the shift to delayed return, you had some loss of trust in nature, a kind of a break from nature and a loss of trust, which is reflected in sedentism and the development of a more complex array of tools, storage and preparation of foods for storage, to kind of survive a world seen as less reliably giving. So it seemed to represent a shift in worldview. And we don't know exactly why this shift occurred. That's as much a mystery in many ways as why agriculture came about. But I wanted to call into question a little bit these assertions and assumptions made about indigenous land management, because I think there's reason to believe that it may not be as benign as many many primitivists believe it to be.
Right. So, in your estimation, is the progression to be immediate return? Is that where it kind of starts for everyone, and then it goes to delayed return, and then potentially agriculture?
Yeah, everyone was at one time immediate return hunter-gatherer. You can go back to Homo erectus. You can go back to the earliest humans. Gorillas are immediate return hunter-gatherers, basically.
Yeah.
So everyone was that until somewhere in the Upper Paleolithic when delayed return kind of emerged. And then with delayed return, you had population growth.
Right.
That's one of the key things. The populations began to grow because we used to think that only agriculturalists developed food surpluses, and that was a big key to why you got population growth among agriculturalists. Well, it turns out it's pretty well established now in the archaeological literature that delayed return hunter-gatherers, complex hunter-gatherers, also developed food surpluses. And these surpluses are closely linked with population growth. In fact, I'll quote a quick quote from one of the writers on indigenous land management. Nancy Turner, who is a co-editor of a book called Keeping It Living on indigenous land management in the Northwest, said, clearly extensive and successful systems of resource management were necessary in order that each cultural group could survive and expand its population to the high densities suggested. And there are multiple quotes like that through the literature on indigenous land management. The surprising thing is that the authors rarely seem to see it as a problem. They look at it more admiringly as like, look what these very efficient methods of land management were able to produce, these high dense populations of people. I look at that and I say, uh-oh, you know, this is a problem. And this seems to be the precursor to agriculture. That's why some of the other terms used for indigenous land management are proto-agriculture, and sometimes referred to as incipient agriculture. I think it was incipient agriculture. Anderson, Turner, some of the other authors fully acknowledge that these people were domesticating plants. In fact, if you read Anderson closely, in a sense, they were domesticating whole ecosystems. Much of her argument is that California's ecosystems evolved along with the humans living there and became dependent on human management, such as burning. However, what seems to go ignored most of the time is how were these ecosystems doing before human arrival, or at least before land-managing humans came along. And I want to acknowledge something. One of the little things that inspired me on some of this was an offhanded comment Guy made in a Facebook conversation maybe 3 years ago or something. Someone was saying something like, you know, these ecosystems need people to keep them in good shape. And Guy made an offhanded comment, something to the effect of, oh, yeah, I'm sure that these ecosystems, before humans came along, they were just crying out for human management. They were in terrible health or something.
Right, waiting for us.
And I thought, yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. Do you remember anything about that guy?
I don't remember that, but, you know, I make a lot of offhand comments, and most of them aren't at all intelligent, so I try to forget them.
Yeah, well, that goes ignored most of the time by a lot of the writers on this land management is, how are these ecosystems doing before humans arrived or before people came along and started burning? And the indigenous land management, I should backtrack and just say it can include things like burning, pruning, weeding, transplanting, coppicing, irrigating, fertilizing, probably forgetting a couple, but quite a few practices like that. Burning tends to be the most common and extensive one. And some of the other assertions made about this are that that indigenous land management basically remade landscapes in every corner of the globe. In fact, I was really surprised. These kind of comments are pretty common from the writers on indigenous land management. What I was really surprised to see was a YouTube video, a talk by anthropologist James C. Scott, who's quite well respected, and I think he must have been reading some of these sources, and he made a comment to the effect that, what would he say? He said, until roughly 100 years ago, there was scarcely any part of the globe that had not been remade by anthropogenic fire. Well, what bugs me is seeing people make these statements without presenting the other side of the argument, which is, for instance, an entire book by edited by Thomas Vail, a collection of essays by geographers and fire ecologists and such, called Fire, Native Peoples, and the Natural Landscape. And in that book, you have a collection of essays covering different regions in North America, mostly in the West. And one by one, every single author comes to conclusions to the effect that this indigenous burning was not nearly as extensive and did not transform the landscape nearly as extensively as a lot of people would have us believe. There's another paper I found similar with one of the same authors from that book called Indian Fire Use, Deflating the Legend. The authors, fire ecologist Stephen Barrett, dendrochronologist Thomas Swetnam, and William Baker, who I believe is a geographer with expertise in fire ecology. Their summary was, the case for landscape-level fire use by American Indians has been dramatically overstated and over-extrapolated. And conservationist Dave Foreman, who many people are familiar with, wrote a little essay called The Myth of the Humanized Pre-Columbian Landscape on this same topic. And his conclusion was, those early explorers and later colonists who, on the basis of the wilderness they encountered, extrapolated that all of the Americas was a wilderness before Europeans, are now imitated by their deconstructors, who, on the basis of native modified spots, extrapolate that all of the Americas was domesticated. Both views are unfounded and silly. And there's this whole little literature pointing in that direction, and it covers, in what I'm writing, I cover North America, Australia, and Europe. But there's a lot we don't know. I want to make it clear, I'm not saying I know this is the way it is and those other people are wrong. Basically, we don't know, but there's a lot of evidence that points in the other direction as well. I talked to an anthropologist named Carolina Malal in Spain, I believe she is now, and she said that it's very difficult to identify any kind of land use practice such as fire in the Paleolithic, because these land use practices would be outside of the normal archaeological sites, And her comment was, maybe a very persistent ground-penetrating radar whiz could spot a paleo grass fire, but then the question would be to distinguish between that and natural fire, thus highly unlikely. So we know very little about the use of fire going back that far, but what some of this evidence does point to is its use was not as widespread and extensive, at least, as many people have suggested.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. MCAT Anderson's work with fire history and prehistory is highly suspect and has been called into question by numerous authors, not just Bill Baker and colleagues. Uh-huh. And I have enormous respect for Bill Baker at the University of Colorado, I believe, in Boulder. Oh, that's right, yeah. You're listening to Nature Bias Labs on the Progressive Radio Network. We have a question from Matt. Matt, who's calling from Florida. Go ahead, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, Guy. I really find the discussion of anthropological history interesting in the light of some of the anti-civilization discussions that go on the show and elsewhere, in that it looks like that if civilization is the problem, that the lifestyle of that civilization, if it was to return to this hunter-gatherer model, it does not sound like it would be that good either. Is this just another nail in the coffin when it comes to the solutions of our current predicament, in that if civilization and if we were to avoid the global dimming effect upregulation of the climate, if all that was to be mitigated in some way, that if we were to live a more simple life, based on the research, does this still mean that we are in trouble?
I think there's a little question that we're in trouble, and I think John's work points toward an approach or a way of living that was a considerable step on the way toward civilization. That storing food allows human population overshoot and therefore the control of people. So I don't think it's an enormous step from that to the model of civilization that most people discuss, which is storing grains and therefore the ability to go into human population overshoot and control people.
Right. My basic contention right now is that the best bet for a model of human sustainability, if somehow there were to be a post-civilization human future, or simply looking back at what are the ways humans have lived, what's the best, if you had to bet on one, which was the most ecologically sustainable, and somehow you could then have the absolute answer given to you, my thinking is the best bet was the immediate return hunter-gatherer society.
And so what kind of carrying capacity are we talking about?
For humans on Earth?
Yeah.
Well, there's not a lot of information on that, but the usual numbers for the number of humans on Earth pre-agriculture were about 5 to 10 million. Now, at all, it'd be interesting to if we could really dissect that, because it turns out that delayed return hunter gatherers were coming along and beginning to grow in numbers during some short period of time before agriculture. Maybe the 5 million is closer to the reality. Of course, if there were some post civilization human future, it might be lower than that due to ecosystem degradation and whatnot that's already taken place.
Right. So when you were talking about factors within delayed return, and when are we talking, I guess my question is, domestication of animals, is that purely agricultural?
Domestication of animals is a tough one. I don't have a lot of information on that. There are hunter-gatherer societies that have been known to keep animals around as pets. Contemporary hunter-gatherers, such as maybe the Hadza, that may use dogs in their hunting. I don't think we know exactly how far back that goes. I don't think it's believed to go back into the early Paleolithic, but maybe 30,000-40,000 years, something like that. But domesticated animals, more like more along the lines of goats or cows or chickens, I think that's getting more agricultural. Although I will say that there's a delayed return hunter-gatherer society in Kenya known as the Okiek, and they are known, they're well known as beekeepers. So they're doing a kind of, I guess you could call that a kind of domestication.
Okay.
But as I mentioned, these delayed return societies were definitely beginning to domesticate plants. One little tidbit I'll throw out, because this is one of the common responses you get to this. You get the response that all animals tend the wild. All animals practice land management. If a bear eats berries here and poops them out there, that's land management. They're planting a berry bush. If an animal browses on a bush, they're pruning it. Well,
right.
these are incidental effects of just living. Humans do all those things too before they start purposefully and intentionally with planning, practicing land management, planning for future effects that they want to see. And so there actually is a good article that I'm going to be including in my, as a reference in my article, that talks about how immediate return hunter-gatherers have arguably beneficial impacts on the ecosystems in which they live just by living there. They clear an area to set up a camp. They're there for a few weeks. They leave. The area regrows. Now more sunlight is getting in, allowing for some increase in plant diversity, helping plants grow that normally would be shaded out by the forest canopy, that sort of thing. And they do the same eating and pooping that everyone else does, every other animal. So they are giving back, as some people want to put it. They're giving back just as much as the bear or the raccoon or the chimpanzee is giving back. But they're not doing it through this planned, purposeful manipulation, which seems to be, a function of the delayed return mindset. It's a mindset where we want to take control. We want to manipulate and not trust nature to give. And once we start taking control and planning, it leads to comments to the effect that we can improve ecosystems.
Right.
We can enhance biodiversity. There are a lot of things that are just kind of taken for granted among land management advocates along those lines, and they all have real problems when you start to look into them. I think there was a well-known quote from an ecologist named Frank Egler back in, I think maybe the 50s, roughly, 60s, and he said, "Ecosystems are not only more complex than we think, they're more complex than we can think." And I always keep that in mind when I'm looking at someone saying, we can improve ecosystems. I'm thinking, really? You think we understand ecosystems so well that we can just go in there and start tinkering with them and know that we're improving them?
Clearly we haven't done that.
they're very complex. And even things like trying to increase biodiversity, there are ways in which we can increase biodiversity that may not actually be desirable. The U.S. Forest Service, there was an article by conservation biologist Reed Noss some years ago called "Do We Really Want Diversity?" And his answer wasn't, "No, we don't want diversity," but his answer was, "You've got to be really careful what you ask for and qualify it," because, for instance, the U.S. Forest Service had often justified things like clear-cutting and road building on the basis that they increase biodiversity, because
right.
They do. They create a disturbance which brings in, like, weedy species and edge species, which often come at the expense of species on the interior, and some of the species that we would really like to keep, like large free-roaming predators that need large tracts of undisturbed land. And so some of these assumptions about, we'll go and burn, we'll go in and we'll coppice and we'll increase habitat diversity, I think they're just not doing quite enough analysis ahead of time to really know what they're getting into.
And yeah,
that's one of my concerns for why this is potentially harmful.
It does seem that, you mentioned this earlier, of a mindset or a shift in thought, and it for me, it always seems like it went from whatever it was to kind of a conqueror's mentality.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and you hear people talking in glowing terms about manipulating the land. That rubs me the wrong way. I'm not sure the land is there for me to manipulate it. I highly recommend for that mindset issue, the whole question of hunter-gatherer consciousness, delayed immediate return, the shift to delayed return, Morris Berman's book, Wandering God. What's the subtitle? Wandering God, a study in nomadic spirituality. It's the only book in existence that I know of that's specifically about that. That shift in mindset from immediate return to delayed return. And he talks about some interesting things like how after the time of agriculture, you also had the emergence of some nomadic pastoralists and, you know, some of the famous sort of nomadic warrior societies. And he sees those as maybe unconsciously, but on some level, an attempt to recapture some of what had been lost with the loss of immediate return nomadic hunter-gatherer societies. So you had some of these other kinds of nomadic societies crop up, representing probably a flawed model, but nevertheless some effort to get back something we'd lost.
Right.
Yeah, I think, there's a book by a conservation biologist from the 1970s called The Arrogance of Humanism. And this idea that humans were separate from nature and were somehow different from other animals is, I think, the whole story of what you're talking about. I mean, the immediate return, a lot of animals do that, including non-human animals, and humans doing that doesn't seem that different. But then once we separate ourselves as doing something completely different and treating the world as our resource or as our bank of resources, it seems like we're headed for utter disaster at that point.
Right. And a big part of it being the population growth that seems to be linked with food surpluses. Online, often debates crop up when I've talked about this from people who have spent a lot of time in the wild saying, well, you got to store some food for the winter, but there seems to be a difference between storing enough food to get a family through the winter versus creating a true food surplus where you start to have somebody managing it and you're it's starting to be enough that it increases the number of humans, and then you've got to create more surplus to keep ahead of the number of humans, and you end up in this endless trap.
Right, it's a self-reinforcing feedback loop. A classic example where I live is the Membrés culture, which discovered maize, corn, about right around 1,000 years ago. And 20 years later, almost exactly 20 years later to the year, the society completely collapsed. And a few survivors walked away. And when the survivors returned to the area, they knew about civilization. They knew about food storage for the long haul. And they didn't do it, because they actually learn from their mistakes. More recent humans haven't taken the hint there.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And my fear is that some of the young primitivists out there hear the word indigenous and just think, oh, that's got to be good. Everything indigenous is fine. And I'm as sympathetic as anyone toward the plight of Native Americans. I think it's like the worst human injustice ever perpetrated, perhaps what happened with European contact here. But there are indigenous, Native American agriculturalists, as you mentioned, whose societies collapsed. Others who we don't know what would have happened had it not been for the catastrophe of European contact. We don't know where they were headed, but the indications are that these populations were still growing based on the surpluses from land management practices. And I suspect that they may have been headed toward ecological problems if perhaps on a smaller scale than what we've created with industrial civilization. But still, I think we have to be a little more nuanced in our identification of who was living sustainably and who wasn't. In North America, for instance, the archaeological literature shows very clearly that there's a whole book on the Northwest Plateau in North America that talks about the shift from simple to complex societies, essentially similar to immediate return to delayed return societies. And it was, this is off the top of my head, but it was roughly only 4,000 to 5,000 years ago that this shift occurred. And they don't know exactly why it occurred. There are, you know, a variety of hypotheses about it. But there were people living on the Northwest Plateau who were living as immediate return hunter-gatherer for a number of thousand, several thousand years before the emergence of complex societies and delayed return hunter-gatherers. So my view is, let's go ahead and look back in time, but let's not just stop at a few centuries ago or maybe even a couple thousand years ago. Let's go back to how people were living prior to these manipulative land management techniques, and we'll see if there's something to be learned from that in terms of a model of human sustainability.
So, you know, some of the argument is that it was inevitable that any band would eventually go and become delayed return, and then it would eventually become agricultural. Do you buy into that?
Well, we don't know. There are a bunch of hypotheses for what caused it. There's even one hypothesis that's more along the lines that population growth led to a need to do these things. And the other side of the coin is the hypothesis that doing these things, complexity and delayed return, led to population growth. I tend to think that's probably the correct one, because otherwise we have to answer the question of how did human beings avoid population pressure forcing them to change their way of living for, you know, a couple million years before 10,000 to 12,000 years ago, or in North America 4,000 to 5,000 years ago. But there are other hypotheses for what led to complexity, things like just cultural evolution, like I mentioned, I'm forgetting off the top of my head. There are a number of hypotheses for the causes, but they're debated, and they don't really know exactly. Oh, climate changes, for instance, which seems logical. You would think, well, if climate became more severe, they would need to do more things to ensure a food supply. But humans had been through quite a few changes in climate before that, so I'm just not sure. These hypotheses are all debated, and none of them has emerged as, you know, the consensus at this point. It's a little bit like, why did humans invent agriculture or begin agriculture? I'm kind of thinking that that had something to do with the emergence of delayed return societies. But what caused the emergence of delayed return societies? It's very unclear. Even James Woodburn, who coined the term immediate return, delayed return, what I've seen him say about it is just very tentative and noncommittal. He's said things like, well, it certainly could be that delayed return societies were more likely to appear in colder climates where storage would be more of an issue. But then why didn't they not appear for several thousand years before they did appear? You know, so it's a bit of a mystery that maybe will be unraveled or maybe not.
Yeah, it almost seems that it's something we may just never know.
That's very possible. Yeah. That's very possible. But it's important to keep in mind there are still people out there living today as immediate return hunter-gatherers. Probably the most visible in the media today is the Hadza in Tanzania. And, you know, sadly only a few hundred of them are actually living as immediate return hunter-gatherers, but they are still doing it today. And a very few others. And so it's something that, at least in some places, has been able to survive and continue straight through since the earliest humans.
Right.
Whether it will be able to continue into the future in some way or be rekindled in some way, I do not know.
Right. And I guess one of my pet peeves is when people talk about humanity, they're really talking about civilization. And so if they're even people who are talking about being anti-civ, they throw everybody into the civilization model when they talk about humanity, as humanity is, you know, been the curse of this planet. And it's not humanity. It's
right.
It's a particular section
right.
that has, right. has gone awry, really. You know, it's us.
Right. I think so. I would argue
that it's the least humane and therefore least human version of, quote, humanity.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, I would argue that that's the least humane, the least human version of humanity is what we're talking about, the hierarchical white man's world.
Yeah. And the shift to delayed return, I focus mostly on the ecological and sustainability aspects, but there are some anarcho-primitivists and others who are pretty much onto this as well. Kevin Tucker, for instance, who I've spoken with, he wrote the only article I've seen that is sort of overlaps directly with what I'm working on right now. He wrote an article years ago called Against Cultivation and in Defense of Wildness. Mm-hmm. And he told me in communication with him that he's been trying to get people to pay attention to the immediate return, delayed return distinction for the last decade or more. So there are people who are onto it. Usually the anarchist emphasis in it is on the question of egalitarianism versus hierarchy, because groups like the San in the Kalahari and the Hadza are very egalitarian. I mean, it's all relative, and they're not 100% perfectly egalitarian, but relative to other societies, they are quite so.
Okay. Well, we got about a minute left with you, John. What are you working on?
Well, working on this same article I've been talking about. I've got a little ways to go on it. It's always taken me a lot longer than I expected. A few months ago, I thought it was almost finished, and then it just kept expanding into something else and forcing me to do more and more research. So I'm hoping to get this published somewhere. I'll put in a plug for a publication right now out of the University of North Carolina called The Wildernist, Wildernist, N-I-S-T. They're writing some good things. I'm probably going to be promising this first to the Canyon Country Zephyr, where my last article was published, but I have a feeling it's going to be way too long and academic for them, so I might move over to The Wildernist or some other publication. I'll get it published somewhere, either as a multi-part article or one long, very long article. I'm glad we had the chance to talk.
Yeah, well, please share it once it gets published on our wall and let us know about it. We'll share it around.
Absolutely, we'll do.
All right, thanks, John. We appreciate your time, and hopefully we can have you on again sometime.
Thanks, guys. I enjoyed being on.
All right.
Talk to you later.
That was John Feeney, PhD, writes about the fundamental drivers and historical underpinnings of the global ecological crisis. Guy, you got a climate update?
Yes, I do. Big thanks to John Feeney for joining us today and also to Matt for calling in. On the climate change front, a paper in the October 12th online edition of Nature Geoscience, authored by British climate scientist Kevin Anderson, has the abstract starting with this sentence, quote, "Delivery of palatable 2 degrees C mitigation scenarios depends on speculative negative emissions or changing the past," end quote. Yeah, changing the past. That's an easy thing to do. Let's just go back in time with our time machine. Kevin Anderson, by the way, is well known for his principled stand on climate change. He has not flown in a commercial aircraft, any sort of airline, for many years now. And so he's sort of taking a stand. The abstract scolds the academic community by concluding with this sentence, quote, "Scientists must make their assumptions transparent and defensible, however politically uncomfortable the conclusions," end quote. Good luck with that, Dr. Anderson. A write-up in the Popular Press indicates Anderson blames the media as well as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and he says researchers are censoring themselves, worrying too much about the opinions of others or whether they'll be liked or not after publishing their studies. No kidding. It seems like I've been pointing this out for years. If you want to be popular, don't publish radical findings.
That seems to be an influence of Facebook with the like button.
No kidding. I mean, legitimate, self-respecting scientists are actually censoring themselves because people might not like what they have to write and might not like what the consequences are? Come on. This is
people
insane.
People don't like to feel bad, guy.
Shut up. Oh, sorry.
Hey, quit being an alarmist.
So I heard.
Speaking of which, why don't you give us a quick plug of what's coming up? You're going to be on the TV.
Yes, I'm going to be on the Idiot Box that I haven't watched myself for many, many, many years now. I'll be featured on the National Geographic channel in a show called Bill Nye's Global Meltdown. Bill Nye, the science guy, actually came up to the Mud Hut and spent about 6 hours filming along with a crew of seven other people. And that all went into this episode that's going to air November 1st. That's Sunday, November 1st at 8 on the coasts and 7 Central and Mountain Time. So look for that. The commercial for the thing, the 30-second commercial, calls me an alarmist. And while I'm happy to admit that the information is alarming, I don't think I'm an alarmist for pointing out that it's alarming. So this might very well be a hatchet job, the likes of which I've become accustomed to.
So there, yeah, you may actually feel bad after this.
Yeah, I feel pretty bad about it already.
Well, you'll get over it.
I deserve that for being an alarmist, I suppose.
I guess you do. Okay, anything else before we hit the road here?
No, let's wrap it up, man.
Okay, well, that wraps it up this week. Thanks for the call, Matt. Thanks to John Feeney for being our guest and giving us a lot of information. I'm going to actually have to go back and listen to it because it was plenty for me to take in and learn from. So make sure to like our Facebook page at Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. And feel free to post questions you'd like us to address in the show. And please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. And we'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be chatting with rewilding expert Jariah Bowser, and we'll be taking your calls as well. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. And thanks again for the calls and to Afrozen for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.